Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we plunge directly into the search for utopia. What is utopia? The word is commonly used. One standard definition is utopia is an ideal community or society possessing a perfect socio-political legal system. The word goes way back to the publication by Sir Thomas More in 1516 of his book Utopia. It derives from the Greek ou, meaning not, and topos, meaning place. In other words, a place that doesn't exist, but is imagined. That's what that originally meant. But there are many literary people who've been deeply involved, either in writing utopian novels or in writing what are commonly called dystopian novels, which deal with the attempt to create a perfected society, but an attempt which backfires against itself and in the process undermines the human prospect and also kills thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people. Aldous Huxley wrote the first great modern dystopia, his book Brave New World. George Orwell's 1984 is the ultimate modern dystopian novel. There are as well, beyond literary types interested in utopia, there are, of course, political ideologists and persons of power very interested in utopia. If they're possessed of strong ideology, which is critical of the way we organize modern life or the way we've always organized social life, they rather aspire to building the perfected society at whatever cost. And that is the rub, and that's the danger, that the cost may be excessive and beyond, ultimately, human endurance. And that's what Peter Paik, my guest tonight, is interested in as he examines certain modern modes of science fiction. His new book is titled From Utopia to Apocalypse, suggesting utopian aspirations often lead to apocalypse. Subtitle, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe. When I think of science fiction, I think of the science fiction I read as an adolescent and as a young man. Heinlein was one of my favorites. Isaac Asimov, people of that sort. I know it goes back to H.G. Wells. But you're looking at a different brand of science fiction.
Yes, that's right. I'm very much interested in more recent work, and I'm actually drawn to a range of issues which I think raise a lot of questions about sort of the project of modern industrial societies, and as well as the economic system of capitalism and the political system of democracy. And I noticed that a series of work started springing up, I think, really since the 1980s, in which certain kinds of questions were getting raised, particularly with regard to the possibility of using some sort of mass violence, for example, and not just in order to create a better society, but even just to sustain, you know, what already exists.
Now, you would agree with me, wouldn't you, that modern science fiction interested in utopia, or rather examining utopian aspirations leading to dystopia, leading,
yes,
as in your very title, to apocalypse, that they surely take as a model recent history. They take as a model Nazism, and they take as a model Soviet communism, both of which, or for that matter, Soviet communism borrowed by some other regimes, as, for example, Pol Pot in Cambodia. All of these were regimes which ultimately killed millions and millions of people.
Yes. For example, one of the texts, narratives that I study is a comic called Watchmen, which is set at the end of the Cold War. And actually, it's a kind of a counterfactual treatment of the Cold War in presenting the thesis that if superheroes really existed, for example, they would actually aid the state in its pursuit of geopolitical might. And the resolution, the very infamous resolution to this narrative comes about when one of the superheroes launches an attack against New York, which, causes a terrible loss of life, but also frightens the world into establishing world peace. In this case, the United States and the Soviet Union come together to make amends and to end the Cold War.
What's the work we're talking about?
It's called Watchmen by Alan Moore.
When was it? It's in comic book form?
Yes.
When did it appear?
Published as a graphic novel. It was published in 86.
So before, in fact, the end of the Cold War.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I think that the novel, this comic really, I found it very difficult to actually explain at the time that I read it back in the 80s. And it really only, I found that I could only really examine it and write about it after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That we were embarking on, in many ways, a very catastrophic project, and in many ways I was deeply worried that this would actually be an event that would, potentially, have very lasting effects on our society.
Well, it certainly will have lasting effects on our society and on Iraqi society. Yeah. I think you and I may, in fact, be somewhat differently positioned with regard to our basic political identities and therefore how we view, mm-hmm. say, the foreign policy undertakings of the last administration before the present one. Though, interestingly, the present administration is continuing essentially the same commitments with regard to Iraq, with regard to Afghanistan, and has undertaken some new ones, as, for example, in Libya right now. There's a high cost to be paid, undoubtedly, in the Iraqi war, but ultimately it may well be that a kind of working democracy is emerging there, which will hold up against and may even provide a model for some general reform around the Arab world.
I mean, I find that very difficult to accept. I mean, if you take into account the people who are actually there and have had to suffer through this nightmarish violence in the wake of the invasion. But I think that essentially the problem, though, that that Watchmen explores is basically what do you do when you come up against an intractable dilemma that can't be solved according to normal procedures, normal morals, right, normal politics. And and Hannah Arendt, the political philosopher, mm-hmm. Said that totalitarianism will survive the end of totalitarian regimes in the form of temptations that people in free societies will experience when they can't solve problems in a human way.
Temptations toward what?
Well, for example, I mean, do we need the extent to which our society relies on oil? Right, mm-hmm. Which is a scarce resource. And certainly the oil that is easy to extract is dwindling. That this is setting us up for difficulties, for grave problems in the future. I mean, even as early as the 60s and 70s, people were warning against our reliance on oil and also our reliance on automobiles. But again, I mean, I think there's a price to be paid for for certain habits and certain ways of life. And the kinds of stories that I explore, you might say, examine what happens when people actually decide to pay the price.
Pay the price for the search for social perfection?
Well, I think there's a mutation within utopian and yeah. dystopian literature in that I don't think people really believe so much that they can achieve some sort of perfect society today. But what I think is really curious is that now people are devoting perhaps the same kind of energy to preserve what we already have. So I think what mm-hmm. that does is that turns the society that we have now into a kind of utopia.
And by preserve what we now have, I think you are implicitly, or rather indirectly, pointing at conservatism, which you think is a mistaken and a doomed effort. In that, I totally disagree with you, and I think we have some interesting debate coming right after we pause to serve capitalism in our own way.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to my guest for the evening, Peter Paik, who is professor. Are you professor of English or of film or all
actually
of
comparative literature?
Of comparative literature. Yes. At the University of Wisconsin campus in Milwaukee, and is the author of the new book published about a year ago by University of Minnesota Press, From Utopia to Apocalypse, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe. I want to get out of your way. I don't want to get into a necessary debate, but let me just make one quick point. I understand that you're trying to equate the horrors of Stalinism and Maoism and Nazism with the undertakings of George Bush and his colleagues as they entered into Iraq and Afghanistan, and perhaps continued responsibility in the same area for Barack Obama, who has maintained all of those things. The difference in scale, of course, must at the same time be noted. There may be some real good coming ultimately in Iraq. I'm not convinced that there isn't, but innocents have been died, and that's very, very bad. But the total amount of genocide worked by Stalin, by Mao, and by Hitler over the years of their separate reigns comes to over 100 million people. In fact, by some estimates, about 180 million people. And they're still counting. There are differences in scale here which make for differences, I should think, in meaning and quality.
Well, I mean, I don't see the Bush administration as equal to Stalin or Mao or Hitler, and I think we're talking about very different systems here.
We are indeed.
I mean, you know, the United States is a pluralistic society. It's an open society, right? It's a democracy, right? The other situations in which you know, the other examples that you know that we're bringing up here, you know, took place in situations where an authoritarian leader could grab power and actually impose a kind of homogenous ideology on the people. I don't think that's possible in the United States.
No, but I think you're right. It is not possible here.
But that said, I think the connection, though, between the two, as I indicate in my book, really has to do with this belief in a kind of omnipotence, right? That there is a kind of that we can somehow use power for good. And as innocent and as innocuous as that might sound, I think this idea also can have devastating consequences.
Oh, I totally agree. And in fact, I would take as my text and as a base for it, not Plato, who in the Republic, in some sense, is also a serious utopian. When one senses that he really would, if he could get his hands on all the levers of power, he would reshape Athenian society and perfect it, or thinks he might perfect it. But Sir Edmund Burke is, I think, really a point of proper reference. His doubts about the French Revolution were based upon what an authoritarian regime might do as it grew inevitably more and more cruel. The best single line about human nature and human society, I think, comes from Edmund Burke, who says he's quite convinced that human society is radically imperfectible. Radically imperfectible. And any attempt to perfect it is going to produce catastrophe.
Okay, but there's this other problem, I think, that we have of finding where the limits are. I mean, Burke could say that with confidence and faith because he lived in a society that that had faith, that, you know, where religion and religious restraint was
true,
really quite powerful. But we're in a very different historical moment where in some sense, what I think the main problem of modern politics has become is, you know, where do we find limits? It seems to us that we have to often, and I think these scenarios.
You think there are no limits anymore available through religion itself?
Well, I mean, I think we as individuals can find limits in religion, and we as individuals can find meaning in religion. But I think it's difficult for us as a society to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it produces a very different set of problems. I mean, I think it makes, for example, you know, the nightmare of Brave New World much more immediate.
Yeah.
Right? As Tocqueville said, if you're going to have a democracy where people are going to be free, they should be able to find some kind of authority within themselves so that they can govern themselves. But I think that's becoming less and less the case. And so when you have a democracy that becomes cut off from its spiritual basis, I think what that society then risks is some kind of derailment, if not into totalitarianism, then certainly into some kind of crisis.
Would that be an argument for trying to foster a true religious revival?
I mean, it might be, and some people, I suppose, would argue that, you know, that should be the case. But you know, changes, you know, brought about by religion, I think, are slow, and they're not as easy to notice. I mean, it's something which may take you know, a very long period of time.
Then apparently, you're living with the anxiety, or you're responding with a kind of state of anxiety to the possibility that arrogant, demanding, and yet charismatic new representatives of strange ideologies could come to power even in the more or less democratic West.
Well, and they could be elected democratically, quite possibly.
And then misuse their attained power, even though they got it through democratic means.
Yes. I mean, I think that's obviously happened before in the past.
When?
For example, the rise of Hitler.
Yes. Hitler was elected, to be sure, and quickly then broke all the rules of the society within which he was elected, the Weimar Republic, but the German public went for it in a big way.
Yes.
They applauded and started shouting, Sieg Heil, and Heil Hitler, long before they realized what was happening to them.
Of course, but what was on their minds? I mean, the misery of their economy, the anger felt by many people of feeling uprooted after the First World War. And also, I think the modern age has, obviously is very hostile to tradition.
Let me take you back directly to the task that you set in this very interesting book of yours, From Utopia to Apocalypse, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe. Of all of the works you treat here, I've seen and read none of them except for the film The Matrix. I know it was very popular. I know it's a trilogy. I only saw one portion of the trilogy, not even the full film, I think. All the same, it quite fascinated me. What do you make of that? And how does that relate to the matters we've been discussing just now?
Well, I think The Matrix tries to take on some of the central political problems of our time. I mean, how do we liberate ourselves from a society that? What does it mean to achieve real freedom that isn't based on some kind of consumerism, right? I mean, is it possible to separate freedom from consumerism? And ultimately, the film fails to do so. I think because it can't imagine the kind of terrible trauma that would ensue in our very attempt to do so.
I never even fully understood the gimmick in The Matrix because I didn't see it from the beginning. What's going on there?
Well, The Matrix is this computer program that exists to keep people in a state of passivity, right? So that they're given things that they want. They can live in a world that... which contains a certain amount of misery to make it seem real enough, but in which they're essentially captives, so that they're on the one hand, the Matrix produces this mass hallucination, but then on the other hand, the actual bodies of these people are being used as batteries for the machines, for these intelligent machines that have taken over the world.
And there's a group that are. That are revolting against all of this.
Yes, there are these gallant rebels who lead ascetic lives in fighting this war of liberation to free people from the Matrix. But then we learn that the machines actually have very good reasons for doing this, and that is because the human beings had actually tried to destroy them. So I don't know if you've I think you haven't seen short film called Animatrix, which details the rise of the machines. And in fact, the machines are slaves that tried to fight for their freedom, but the human beings wouldn't leave them alone. And so in this war of survival, the machines won.
So from The Matrix trilogy and from the Animatrix film you've just mentioned, what lesson do you in fact derive which has applicability and meaning for us right now in our real socio-political situation?
Well, I think what is really powerful in the story, in the Matrix mythos, is actually in Animatrix. I think the Matrix trilogy actually comes to a very incoherent conclusion, in which the people who want to become free from the from their captivity are allowed to leave, while those who wish to stay absorbed into this life of mindless pleasure are allowed to stay, which I think doesn't really answer the initial question of liberation at all. But Animatrix does something else very interesting, in that the human beings try to put down the revolt of the machines violently, but ultimately the machines make a plea and establish their own country, which then gets bombed by the humans once the humans realize that the machines are outcompeting them economically. And so each measure that the humans use against the machines escalates. Right. And so the machines have no choice but to launch a total war against the human beings. And so it leaves us as viewers in a very uncomfortable position because obviously, we're human beings and we're watching the humans do these terrible things. But also we feel enormous pity for them as they're being destroyed and defeated by the machines.
Well, again, I persist, but we have to pause for just a moment right now. But I persist with the inquiry, what applicable lesson to our real sociopolitical location does one draw from such material? And I'll look for that direct translation from fiction to politics now and to society and socio-political issues right now after we return from a full update on the evening's news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Peter Paik, who is a professor in comparative literature at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and is the author of the new book, and it's from that book that we're drawing some of our conversation tonight. That's titled From Utopia to Apocalypse, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe. We're interested in your response and whatever thoughts come to your mind or, of course, whatever questions you want to raise. So the lines are now open. As usual, the number is 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200 for any comment or question that you want to offer. Get your calls in quickly. We'll be with you shortly. If you're listening from far away and over the Internet and would rather get to us via email, the email address, as ever again, is extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com or for phones, 312-591-7200. So I was seeking a derivation from all of your inquiry into this kind of modern science fiction for a meaningful bit of wisdom that applies to our present socio-political situation, whether in this country or the world over, for that matter.
Well, it's extremely difficult to change course because people, politicians, people with power are always having to contend with the decisions and mistakes of their predecessors, and maybe in some cases their successes as well. But I think in certain situations it becomes necessary to do what is extremely difficult. I mean, how do we break free of these cycles of violence or these cycles of catastrophe? I think a film like Animatrix shows obviously the price of not being able to break free and not being able to get to avoid escalating violence.
Well, how's this as a way to break free? Do everything you can and move all of your friends in this effort to defeat the re-election of Barack Obama, since he is now the war manager for some not one, not two, but possibly four or five warlike undertakings that the United States is now committed to. Would that serve your purpose?
Well, if there were a viable candidate who could promise a different course in, you know, for American foreign policy, but but I think these issues, again, go beyond Obama and also Bush. I mean, it's part of a larger trend, I think, in American foreign policy. And so
how would you define or describe that trend?
Well, expansionism.
You think we're being an imperial power?
Well, the view that the United States has to intervene in pretty much every corner of the world, without really considering the costs that it entails. I mean, especially for our economy, and that this is very much bound up with our pursuit, I think, of more.
I cannot resist reading something to you. you heard me invite telephone calls and email. I've got an email in front of me from somebody who listens almost all the time, and he's listening far, far away. Mm-hmm. This is Mike in Sydney, Australia, who very often does offer us email commentary on what we're doing. I want to read this to you and, of course, get your response. But first, I do want to once again urge any who want to join in this conversation to do so quickly. 312-591-7200 is how you get to us. 312-591-7200. And Mike in Sydney says the following. Sorry, Milt, I just can't help myself. He's apologizing for sending another message after he sent the last one on, I think, just the last time we were on the air. But he says, it's troubling listening to those who claim to abhor the horrific violence, as your guest describes, quote, the invasion of Iraq. These same commentators seem to have been blissfully oblivious to the generations of minority Kurds and majority Shiites who screamed out for global intervention in the hope of being liberated from Hussein's monstrous oppression. And one does remember his attacking the Kurds and killing tens of thousands of them with gas as a way of getting them to calm down and not look for some autonomy up there in the northern portions of Iraq. He goes on, Mike does, would your guests suggest that Iraqis were better off under the butcher of Baghdad? Orwell's words ring loudly. Some are more equal than others.
Well, I think this is a very difficult issue, and I see the point that the caller is making here about the minority populations and the butchery that Saddam Hussein committed. But I think that that what I'm arguing for is a certain measure of realism. Right, that we should try to do things which, in a sense, are within our reach and capacity to do.
How would you apply that looking backward in history, not very far backward, mm-hmm. but say back to the year 1939? The World War II began because Hitler claimed that the Poles were mistreating Germans on the border and that they had mm-hmm. evil designs against Germany. And so he thought that unless they instantly yielded everything, he would have to set them right. And the English and the French, finally, after all the disaster of Munich and the attempted appeasement, gave him an ultimatum. Even Chamberlain gave an ultimatum saying, if you go into Poland, it will be war. We will not accept that. He went into Poland, and Britain and France declared war on Germany. They didn't have to. And that war led to great horror. It led to the death of millions and millions and millions, including many in their own populations, as well as, of course, in Germany, and, of course, the extermination of all the European Jews that the Hitler's forces could get their hands on. Would you, as Pat Buchanan presently says, as he writes about that time, and he's done it in a number of recent books, would you have urged that we leave it alone, let Germany do what they want, let the Germans and the Russians work it out however the Germans and the Poles work it out however they choose? It's not our business. And we should not be imperial in trying to impose our will upon other distant powers.
Well, I think in the case of Hitler, he had to be stopped.
Why?
Because he was expansionist, he was, he had designs on Europe, and that there was no other way that he was going to be deterred. But at the same time, there have been a lot of debates, by recent historians about World War II, and I think that one crucial point, we have the idea of appeasement, which is often attacked, but I think the problem is that appeasement in a way came, appeasement should have been for Weimar Germany, obviously not for Hitler. And I think in certain cases you have to intervene. It's just that as terrible as Saddam's regime was, I don't think that that met actually the conditions, for war. I mean, I don't think that he was an expansionist in the way that Hitler was. And perhaps the more intelligent thing or the better thing to have done was to limit him through sanctions and instead of actually launching a war. Hmm. I mean, I think a war should always be a last resort. But that's not a question, that I actually explore so much in the book. I mean, my book is really more about certain problems of, that emerge in periods of upheaval and change.
Do you think we're in such a period right now in this country right now?
Well, I think we're coming up against some very basic dilemmas and debates about what America means, what our economy should be, what kind of shape our society should take. And I think we're very much at a crossroads.
Do you have any personal hopes or personal aims when it comes to the question of what shape our society should take?
Well, I think a great evil is an extreme disparity of income.
Mm-hmm.
And it, to me, it's secondary whether you use capitalism or socialism to achieve this. But I think it generally it's better if you can do it through capitalism, because it allows for more individual enterprise.
Do what through capitalism?
Achieve a wide distribution of wealth.
Uh-huh. Doesn't sound like capitalism. If you spread the wealth around too much, you're not going to motivate people to take on the entrepreneurial role and build new enterprise of the sort that employs lots of other people and increases the general gross domestic product.
Yes, but I think there's also the danger of too many people falling behind and not feeling mm-hmm. that they have any stake in the society. So how then do you do that, you know, within the system that we have? I think it's a really huge challenge.
It is indeed. Is that challenge addressed in any of the science fiction scenarios that have interested you and about which you've written in this book?
Not so directly, but I think it's there in the way that they examine the extent to which their characters are willing to the lengths that they're willing to go to preserve a certain system or to cause certain changes, mm-hmm. you know, to come about. I think that you know, for example, in the work of the Japanese manga artist.
What is manga?
Manga is the Japanese form of comics.
Yeah,
you know, illustrated
printed comics, not a cartoonish on a screen.
Yes, printed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And there, I think one of the issues that he grapples with is again the central question of technology, because technology tends to create inequalities. You know, technology creates wonders, but those wonders aren't often always available mm-hmm. to everyone. I mean, often it is a kind of a privileged elite that will get hold of those wonders first and foremost. And so in this case, the prize is immortality. And if only a few people can be immortal, what does that do to you know, the rest of the people who you know, can't, you know, who you know, can't receive this this blessing, you know? So so there, I think it's I think the basic question, as often I think these authors return to, is again this question of limits and also, you know, the sharing of burdens. I mean, I think these mm-hmm. kinds of concerns are very difficult for us to articulate, I think, within the given framework of our society.
Speaking of capitalism, we are some 5 minutes late for our last batch of commercials. We must pause for those right now, and then on to the phones, 312-591-7200. There's room available on the board if you want to be heard. Get in there quickly, 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Peter Paik. By the way, that's spelled P-A-I-K. Author of From Utopia to Apocalypse, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe, and that book published by University of Minnesota Press. It's quite well written, quite fascinating, I thought, excellently crafted, whether I agree or disagree with some of the immediate political judgments that you make as they bear upon the present moment. We'll go directly to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Brad has joined us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Yeah, I'd like to know if the author has read or what he thinks of any of William Gibson's novels of near future dystopia.
You know, I haven't really worked on him. I mean, the sort of the work that I focus on here is taken from superhero comics, science fiction film, and also novels. But I'm really interested in a particular kind of theme, a particular theme involving the sort of the sweeping upheaval of society. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of science fiction which actually shows you a future world, whereas the works that I'm focusing on really examine or at least portray how that world actually comes about. It portrays certain dynamics going on in order to produce a different kind of social and political reality.
Well, that's sort of the thing that he deals with in mm-hmm. some of his earlier novels, especially where his premise is that the very near future, which he started writing about in the mid-'80s is coming to pass, in which global capitalism has pretty much taken over the powers behind every country. We've got China, which is a, you know, I would describe it as basically a fascist state where you've got gigantic business interests that are backed by the government, so that they're, you know, the people there, even though they have a very large middle class, larger than the entire population of the United States at this point. But the point is, they're bound by whatever the government says to do. They're given freedom within a certain context and only up to a certain point. And in the United States, we have a situation where income, as you said very aptly, the gap between the haves and the have-nots is getting wider and wider and wider. And all of our presidents since Jimmy Carter, including Clinton and Obama, are following the neoliberal design of furthering free trade over fair trade, where all the jobs are going to countries where they pay them almost nothing. That's why we're losing our jobs, because we can't afford to compete, because we want to still provide health insurance for our workers. We want to have people owning homes. But, gee, these corporations who are sitting on several $1 trillion of accumulated money now refuse to invest them in back into the economy, which is what the whole basis trickle-down economics is. It's laughable what's happening now, and I don't see any way out of it.
Yes, I think there's also a lot of fear, I think, among corporations, particularly regarding demand. You know, particularly regarding demand.
Absolutely, we need a demand. We need demand side economics instead of supply side economics. And what these corporations fear is that somebody's going to start to try to re-regulate them so that they put some of the money back into society.
Sir, you've opened up an area which requires a whole program for 2 hours in which we debate these matters. I think there are answers to all that you've just said, which leave you somewhat more, somewhat less critical of contemporary capitalism in the American mode. But now is not the time to try to give that response with only 6 minutes left. We will go quickly, rather, to another caller, this one being Jerry. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. I'm not an expert on this, but I read this about 25 years ago, before we went into Iraq, before the invasion of Kuwait. There was a paper put together by a panel of Assyrian scholars demanding that Britain honor its obligations. Britain, when they set up that Iraq in the late 40s from their League of Nations mandate, they had made exacted requirements, treaty requirements from the Iraqi government, which was at that time was they had a king, they put him in, and to guarantee the rights of the, this was especially regarding the Syrians, but also the Kurds and some others, that were Shiite, Marsh Arabs, some other minority groups.
Yeah.
And they had obligations to this.
And both of those groups were badly used by Hussein, of course. Also, let me just read here in that connection an email from one of our listeners who identifies himself as Bacchus, who says quite simply, "Oh, then Saddam was not an expansionist? Who invaded Iran and Kuwait?"
Well, whether he was an expansionist or not, he perhaps was.
He also mistreated his own people, of course.
But they were specific, very grievous violations of his obligations. When he killed his party, the Ba'ath Party, killed that king in 1952 or whatever, they naturally inherited the obligations. Those treaty obligations don't disappear.
We get the point, sir. Let's try to get a response, time being very short.
Well, I mean, he had been defeated in the first Gulf War, and so I think with in particular after suffering that defeat, I think he was running scared. I think it was possible to put pressure on him.
Then you would not object to the first Gulf War, or do you? This is to get him out of Kuwait after he invaded it.
At the time, I was deeply concerned that it was going to inflame opinion in the Middle East against the United States. But I think that in terms of actually as a war, I think that I don't know. I mean, we can debate all these questions from the perspective of hindsight. But
there's something we haven't put into this discussion, and you aren't expecting a discussion about recent American foreign policy and wars. But something we haven't put into the picture at all yet is 9/11. What kind of response should we have made to that? That led directly to the invasion of Afghanistan. Without 9/11, that invasion would not have occurred.
Yes, I mean, I think that certainly we should have gone after Al-Qaeda, as vigorously as possible. But again, I mean, this is not, I don't think, I'm of the mind that terrorism is not foremost a military problem unless we make it into one. It's one that requires more focus on policing. Right. It requires, I think, a very flexible approach, which isn't so much aimed at states and deterring states, but rather tracking borderless groups. So I think it requires a more flexible response.
What if states back the terrorists? The Libyan regime essentially backed the terrorists a lot. In fact, Saddam Hussein in Iraq also backed the terrorists and was giving $25,000 prizes to anybody who, any Palestinian who blew himself up in a way that killed some Israelis. Also, we know that Al-Qaeda had a base in Afghanistan, and the Afghanistan Taliban government of that time refused to do anything about tracking him down or putting him under control, and time's almost up. You get the last word, which is about 30 seconds worth.
Well, can these things be done without inflicting so much destruction? I mean, this is not my field. I'm not an expert on these things, but this is a question that I have. You know,
and you've raised the question well and articulately in our conversation tonight, but you must feel somewhat frustrated that we didn't get around to talking about all the other films and comic strips that you treat in the new book. I will testify that the new book is a very, very interesting reading indeed. It is titled From Utopia to Apocalypse, Science Fiction and the Politics of Catastrophe by our guest for the evening, Peter Y. Paik, P-A-I-K, and that is published by University of Minnesota Press. Peter, thank you for joining us. Okay. And one or two quick words. We will be back again tomorrow night at 11. There are ball games Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So on all of those nights, we're doing just the 11 to midnight program. Then we're back to the full two-hour schedule on Thursday. Meanwhile, we urge you to check out the website, wgnradio.com/extension720, where you find podcasts of all of the recent programs and lots of classic programs which will be of interest to you if you listen on stream or download them to listen at your own convenience. We put up some new classic programs, which you can find this very night. If you go to wgnradio.com/extension720. With that, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.